Hello everyone and welcome to Blood Runs Cold, a true crime podcast looking at cases from around the world involving murder, missing persons, miscarriages of justice and more, with the aim of putting the emphasis on the victims of these crimes, to humanise them and not to just look at them as another statistic. I'm Peter, creator and host of this podcast, and in this episode I'm going to take a look at the murder of 12-year-old Thomas Marshall in Norfolk back in 1997, the investigation that followed, and how a single piece of vital evidence helped bring a sick, predatory paedophile to justice. Now, before we get going, I'd just like to say that there are topics in this episode and in all of my episodes that may be a little bit triggering or upsetting for people, so I would suggest you proceed with caution, read the synopsis or the show notes or whatever, just to see what the episode's about and then decide if you want to proceed from there. But anyway, let's get on with the case. This case first came to my attention when I moved to Norfolk from London back in 2014. I moved to a place called the Bush Estate in Eccles-on-Sea, and during a little walk around the estate to take in my new surroundings, I found it odd when I saw a post box, like a mailbox, whatever you want to call it, basically situated in someone's front garden. For those of you wondering what it is, it isn't a box that letters would be delivered to, because that would make sense for it to be in the front garden of someone's house, wouldn't it? It's a Red Royal Mail post box that people post letters in for the postman to later collect and take back to the depot for sortation and delivery and stuff. But anyway, I found it a bit weird that whoever lived there would have had their neighbours turning up on the doorstep to post their Christmas cards and whatnot. I made a bit of a joke about it at the time, but later found out the reason for the post box is that there used to be a shop on the site, like a newsagent's or convenience store, whatever you want to call it, where people would buy their essentials. And then, more interestingly, I found out the shop was linked to a murder, and I became really intrigued. For those of you interested in the location, the Bush Estate sits in an ancient fishing village in northeast Norfolk called Eccles-on-Sea, around 20-odd miles outside of Norwich, and which over time has mostly been washed into the sea. Nowadays, the Bush Estate takes up pretty much the entire village and consists of maybe a couple of hundred pre-war bungalows that some say look like wooden shacks. It was originally a holiday retreat with no power or mains drainage, and is now a community made up of a mixture of personalities, and when I first moved to the area I realised some of the locals were rather territorial when it came to newcomers. A few miles down the road and what used to be a short beach walk away when the weather was nice and the tide weren't in, and before coastal erosion ruined it, is the village of Haysburgh, spelt Happysburg, H-A-P-P-I-S-B-U-R-G-H, but definitely not pronounced that way. It's a pleasant village with great views and many landmarks, including a fantastic lighthouse. Back in 1997, 12-year-old Thomas Marshall lived in Haysborough with his parents, John and Carol. He was fair-haired and had a boyish, young-looking face that really showed his age, despite the fact his father said he was extremely mature in a lot of ways. Thomas was a lover of music and his favourite band was Oasis. There's actually a picture I saw of him wearing round sunglasses similar to what Noel and Liam Gallagher had been photographed wearing at the time. He had also started to broadcast a radio show called Radio Thomas over CB Radio. For those who don't know, CB Radio or Citizens Band Radio is a land mobile radio system that allows one person to speak to many others who are on the same frequency as them. Thomas was described as being a helpful boy, with an example of this being when he helped a farmer bring in the harvest during a family holiday away to Yorkshire, and he also enjoyed making model planes and he liked to fix things. He also enjoyed riding the Yamaha Scrambler his parents had brought for him, although his most treasured possession was his red and pink mountain bike that he travelled everywhere on. On Thursday, the 21st of August 1997, the day that his favourite band Oasis released their first album in 2 years, Thomas left his home at 5:45 p.m. on his distinctive and beloved bicycle with his parents, content in the knowledge he was heading off to see his friend Adrian in a nearby village. He was told to be home no later than 9 p.m. and off he pedalled. Sadly, this would be the last time his parents ever saw him alive. When the 9 p.m. curfew came and went and Thomas still hadn't arrived home, his parents contacted Adrian's parents. They were told that Adrian was at home and that they hadn't seen Thomas at all that evening. This was baffling to the Marshalls as they had been told by Thomas he was going to see Adrian. However, even though they must have been concerned, they continued to wait for their son to arrive home. A couple of hours later, when there was still no sign of Thomas, their worry had increased and they contacted police to report their child missing. By morning, search teams including police and the Coast Guard were scouring the country lanes, beaches and fields in the local area, but no sign of the boy was found. Nobody knew where he had gone when he left home the previous evening or what had happened next. The boy's disappearance then took a more worrying turn when his mountain bike was found dismantled in undergrowth near a common a couple of miles away. This development caused the police to call in their most senior operational detective, Les Parrott, and he joined the many feet on the ground who were searching for Thomas. Just over 24 hours have passed since Thomas had disappeared when his parents' worst fears were recognised. The body of a boy matching Thomas's description was found in a lay-by on the edge of Thetford Forest, which is over 50 miles away from Haysborough. The police also identified it as a well-known meeting point for gay men cruising for sex, a detail which would later help them out. The body was soon identified as Thomas. The cause of death was given a strangulation with what appeared to be a combination of the collar of his top and the shoelace necklace he wore, which lay broken on the boy's body. And a major murder investigation was now underway. The locations where Thomas's body was found and where his bicycle had been discovered were both cordoned off as major crime scenes, and forensic teams were called in. This included a pathologist from the Home Office in London. With it being the summer holidays and just a few days before the final bank holiday of the year in England until Christmas, there were thousands of holidaymakers from all over the country who had descended on Norfolk, so potential suspects and witnesses could be from anywhere, and most would likely have already left the county. This posed a big problem for the police, but they proceeded with their inquiries. Police carried out door-to-door inquiries, officers were stopping motorists on the side of the road in an attempt to gather information, and they sifted through hours of video footage from places like petrol garages and stuff. However, the trail was cold and these inquiries led to no new clues or leads. There were appeals from Thomas's parents and then his Aunt Marie, who all gave emotional pleas for information, asking anyone who knew anything about Thomas's murder to come forward. Marie spoke to ITN on the 29th of August, saying, quote, "If you have any suspicions about anyone in your home, your street, your workplace, even if you were somewhere you shouldn't have been and you saw something, please contact the police now. Don't let another innocent child die because you were afraid to speak out." End quote. Detective Parrott decided to hold a national television appeal, so he contacted the BBC programme Crime Watch UK and arranged an appeal to be held on Monday the 1st of September. However, a major national tragedy was about to happen that would inadvertently cause a setback to the case. In the early hours of Sunday the 31st of August, Diana Princess of Wales passed away in a car accident in a tunnel in Paris, France, and this gripped the attention of the entire nation. Unfortunately, this meant that Parrott's appeal would fall mostly on deaf ears. It wasn't because people didn't care about the murder of a young boy. It was because the nation was so swept up in grief for the death of a princess that it took over everything. I remember what it was like back then. Every newspaper, TV, news bulletin, radio show, everything was about Princess Diana. It was all anyone spoke about. Away from the shock and grief of the death of a princess, Norfolk police were in the midst of a long and drawn-out investigation. Inquiries eventually did hit a bit of a roadblock. There were several reported sightings of Thomas, but they were unable to be confirmed, so this in turn ruled out more potential witnesses. Officers sifted through a shitload of rubbish and stuff found at the two crime scenes, but again, it led nowhere. Also, the police were no nearer to finding the location where Thomas was actually killed. They had the location where his body was found, they had where his bicycle had been dumped, but they had no murder scene and no concrete witnesses. This meant a lack of suspects as well. With nothing to really go on, the police had to try and come up with different theories as to what they think happened. The initial theory was that Thomas had been abducted in the spot where his bike was found, killed, and then his body dumped. Although this posed a few more questions. It didn't explain why Thomas would have been in the first spot to begin with, and also why his bike had been dismantled. Also, there were no signs of a struggle at that location. A newspaper article in December 1997 claimed the postmortem showed no clothing was out of place on Thomas's body and that there were no signs of sexual assault, but the second part of that claim was later proven incorrect when it was revealed Thomas had bruising to his genitalia which indicated sexual activity had taken place. The police had to move on from their initial theory and several other ideas were mooted. Maybe Thomas and his friend had fallen out, the friend had killed Thomas and the parents had helped to cover up the crime by dumping the body and the bike. Or maybe it was a lorry driver who had killed Thomas, or a long-distance hiker who was just in the location, saw Thomas and took their chance to kill a young boy. The police also had the idea that Thomas had lied to his parents and was never actually planning on meeting Adrian in the first place. This would mean he was meeting someone else and that the secret person he did meet with was his killer. They just needed to find out if this was indeed the case, and if it was, who that secret person was. There were murmurings of a possible serial killer, with Thomas's murder being linked to several other unsolved murders and disappearances in and around the Norwich area, but this link was tenuous at best and soon ruled out as a possibility. Another theory came after reports there had been a stranger approaching children outside Thomas's school in nearby Stalham. This meant there was potential dirty old man looking for victims outside the school. Perhaps this man had singled out Thomas, followed him, waited for his opportunity and pounced when the time was right to do so. Again, though, it was just a theory. Police had no evidence to suggest it was anything other than that. and it also posed more questions than answers. There was a lack of concrete evidence, a lack of witnesses, a lack of suspects, and police couldn't really come up with a motive. The case was a tough one for police, but everyone remained focused on finding who had killed a 12-year-old boy. The vital evidence police did have, including Thomas's bike and clothes, were sent off for further analysis. More than 70 officers worked around the clock, examining leads, questioning potential witnesses, and eliminating names from their list of suspects. Parrott had searched records of known sex offenders who lived in the local area in order to create that list of suspects, and resources were stretched to the limit in what was becoming an extremely expensive murder investigation. Eventually, with police seemingly no nearer to catching Thomas's killer, the village of Haysborough started to get back to some semblance of normality. Thomas's father returned to work and people got on with their lives as best as they could. Although there were constant reminders, as notice boards within a few miles of his home village contained a photo of Thomas under the caption, "Murdered." In the year after Thomas's murder, three people were arrested, questioned and bailed pending further inquiries. However, no charges were ever brought against any of these people. Thomas's parents and aunt again appealed to the public on the first anniversary of his murder, claiming they believe Thomas must have known his killer. They also told of how the last year had been an emotional roller coaster for the family. Mrs. Marshall said, "Somebody knows who this person is or has a suspicion and we need them to come forward." While Aunt Marie said that they had thought the killer had been caught when the police first arrested someone, but that they had learned to take things more calmly with subsequent arrests. And Mr. Marshall remained hopeful, saying the family firmly believed the police were closer to catching the killer, but that he understood everything had to be done properly. The police and Thomas's family knew the truth was out there somewhere, and the key piece of evidence they needed would soon be found, as a new witness and a suspect's lies, along with a shocking discovery, would seal the fate of the man who killed Thomas Marshall. So time had gone on, 13 months had passed since the discovery of 12-year-old Thomas Marshall's body in a lay-by on the edge of Thetford Forest, just over 24 hours after he had disappeared from his Haysborough home in August 1997. The police investigation had been a long one and had hit several dead ends along the way. However, the police now did have a suspect high up on their list, and that suspect was a man named Kevin Roberts, a shopkeeper who owned a convenience store in front of his bungalow on the Bush Estate in Eccles-on-Sea. Local villagers believe Roberts to be a quiet, hard-working individual, but appearances can be extremely deceiving, and he had many secrets that were about to be revealed. Roberts was already known to the police. He had been cautioned in 1995 for allowing or helping two teenagers to make an obscene video in the bathroom of his bungalow, as well as showing them pornographic material. So, that showed he couldn't be trusted around teenagers, and it wasn't his only secret either. It was also revealed that he was having a homosexual affair with his married cousin. It was the second secret, the affair with his cousin, that exposed a lie in Roberts' story. Previously, when questioned with regards to Thomas's disappearance and murder, Roberts had stated he had no knowledge of the area of Thetford where the boy's body had been found. Police discovered this to be a lie, though, when they found out his married lover's place of work wasn't that far away. Police were also suspicious about something else they noticed during questioning. Roberts could remember full television listings and exactly what he had watched on the night of Thomas's murder, listing off everything one after the other. However, he couldn't do the same for any other night. Police didn't know it at the time of questioning, but it was actually later revealed he had memorised the TV guide in order to give himself an alibi. If those things weren't enough to make Roberts look guilty, police were about to make a discovery that would leave them in no doubt of their suspect's guilt. The police carried out a search of Roberts' bungalow and found a lot of homosexual pornography, with younger boys being his favourite category of choice. But there was another discovery made during his search that turned out to be the key piece of evidence that the detective had been hoping to find. As mentioned earlier, Thomas was strangled with his shoelace necklace, which had broken during its use as a weapon. When the boy's body was found, the necklace was there, but it had two small beads missing. During the search of Roberts' bungalow, police officers found one of these beads in the U-bend under his sink. Right, going on a little tangent here because I know there are plenty of people who love a conspiracy theory. When first asking people about this case or when first finding out a little bit of information about it, it did become clear to me that a couple of people believe Roberts to be innocent of Thomas's murder. I can't actually remember who these people were and I wouldn't give their names out anyway because everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But I was led to believe that some think Roberts was framed by the police. The theory is that because the investigation had cost a lot of money, in excess of £1.5 million in the first year, and the police were under pressure to find the killer, they pinned it on a 50-odd-year-old homosexual shopkeeper who was known to have a caution for a sex offence and a liking for young boys. Just to be clear, this isn't my belief at all. I'm just giving an opinion that I've heard. To be honest, I think it may be a mix of the fact that people love a conspiracy theory and a gossip, as well as the fact that many older residents who may have known Roberts had completely misjudged him. maybe they couldn't quite accept the fact that the hard-working and quiet shopkeeper was in fact a paedophile child killer. So maybe that's the reason why the theory was banded about a little bit. But anyway, let's get back to it. Once they found the bead, police officers had to prove that it had come from Thomas's necklace. This meant a trip to Hong Kong. The detective visited the place where beads were manufactured in to try and confirm a match. Unfortunately, a direct match couldn't be proven either way. Despite this, officers did find out that the bead found in Roberts's U-bend came from the same batch of beads as the ones on Thomas's necklace. So, while there couldn't be a direct match to say that they were definitely the beads that were missing from Thomas's necklace, they did come from the same batch and likely were the same ones. Then, in another turn of events, a former neighbour of Roberts's came forward to say she saw him on the evening of Thomas's disappearance and that he was dismantling a bike. In fact, he was dismantling a red and pink bike that matched the description of the one Thomas rode everywhere he went. Kind of strange, really. It took more than a year for this witness to come forward. The distinctive bike was a key piece of information shared with the public from the outset and throughout the investigation, but still it took this witness a year to come forward and say she saw Roberts dismantling one that matched the description on the night that Thomas went missing. But whatever our reasons for not coming forward earlier, the police now had built up enough of a case to arrest and formally charge Kevin Roberts with the murder of Thomas Marshall. The man who had called himself a not very happy man and who had admitted having a liking for teenage boys was finally going to face a jury, and the trial took place towards the end of 1999. During this trial, the court heard how Thomas had met Roberts at his convenience store in either May or June 1997, and that something sexual had developed between them sometime after. Whilst researching the case, I saw a national newspaper had actually referred to this as a relationship, and there was another report which referred to Roberts and Thomas as lovers. Seeing things like that written really pissed me off, because it was clear Roberts had groomed Thomas, he had taken advantage of him and sexually abused the young boy. Imagine if it was a 50-odd year old man and a 12-year-old girl. Would newspapers be referring to this as a relationship? Absolutely fucking not is the answer to that. There is no way that anyone refers to that as a relationship or says that a 12-year-old girl and a 50-year-old man were lovers. So it's not okay to say about it, to say it about Roberts and Thomas, a 50-year-old man and a 12-year-old boy. It was abuse. Fully fledged sexual abuse of an adolescent boy by a middle-aged man. A sick, twisted man who got his sexual kicks from young boys. DCI Bill Gorham agreed with that point of view as well, referring to Roberts at the time as a cold, calculated and intelligent paedophile, and what had happened between him and Thomas was abuse, not a relationship. Roberts had pleaded not guilty to murder, and he even denied any type of sexual relationship between himself and Thomas had taken place. But he also badmouthed Thomas throughout the trial, saying things like he weren't an angel and that he had robbed from the shop several times. There were other insults as well. Despite the fact Roberts had denied everything in court, it was said that he had told a convicted paedophile while on remand that Thomas was a rent boy, that he hated him, and that the boy had teased him about his sexuality and his liking for young boys. And then Thomas had blackmailed the older man by threatening to tell everyone that he had sexually abused him. The prosecution took the view that this was the motive behind the murder. Roberts had sexually abused Thomas, he had manipulated the boy, and he had used him for his sick sexual gratification, and then had killed him to prevent that sexual abuse being revealed and his secrets from being exposed to the world. Despite Roberts trying to make Thomas look like a tearaway and attempting to somehow paint himself to be the victim, justice would be done. On the 8th of December 1999, the jury gave their verdict that Kevin Roberts was guilty of the murder of Thomas Marshall. It was revealed during a trial that Roberts had purchased cannabis earlier on in the evening. He had killed Thomas. He had lied to his cousin about his plans, as well as possibly persuading Thomas to lie to his parents. And they had planned a meeting. Thomas rode his bicycle to Roberts' home, and it was there that the older man would strangle the 12-year-old and then do what he could to try and get away with murder. In order to try and cover up his crimes, he would dump the boy's body in one location and a dismantled bicycle in another. He then went about his life for the next 13 months, just carried on running his shop and living his life in the bungalow where he killed a young boy, with his neighbours and customers being none the wiser. 13 months of the police trying to gather the evidence they needed to bring the killer to justice and at least give Thomas's family a sense of closure. Sentencing Roberts to life in prison, Mr. Justice Smedley told the now convicted killer, "You have been found guilty of strangling to death a young boy of 12. And that even though the boy may not have been an angel, he didn't deserve to die in the appalling way that Roberts had treated him." After his murder conviction, Roberts tried to force an appeal, but it was rejected out of hand, and he was told he would likely spend the rest of his life behind bars. After this, he apparently had some sort of mental breakdown, and he had to be seen by the prison psychologist. I'm not too sure what happened next with regards Roberts, and to be perfectly honest, it doesn't really matter anyway. I did look to see if I could find any information about him, whether he was still alive, was still in prison or whatever, but there's no information about him anywhere. I'm sure someone somewhere knows, but unfortunately, I don't, so I can't tell you. As for the victims left behind in all this, Thomas's parents, they felt aggrieved that their son had been misrepresented in court. They denied Thomas had been involved with drugs, saying they believed anything he said about them to just be adolescent bravado. They said he was a bright, polite and considerate 12-year-old who was naturally inquisitive, but that he lacked experience and he wouldn't have been able to get himself out of the situation he found himself in. One day before his killer was finally brought to justice, Thomas Marshall would have turned 15. His parents and family were robbed of seeing him even reach his teenage years, let alone adulthood and beyond. It is all what ifs and maybes for them now, wondering what career path he would have taken, whether he would have got married and had children of his own, the type of man he would have become, etc, etc. An evil sexual predator took that away from them. He abused Thomas and then he killed him in an effort to protect himself and hide his wrongdoing. He then went about his life continuing to hide his part in Thomas's murder, whilst a grieving family and friends tried to find the truth. So, I will end this case with something Thomas's parents said after the guilty verdict had been returned. Facing the press, clearly upset but having at least got justice for their son, they said, quote, "Although nothing could bring back our son, the jailing of Roberts ensures he is not able to prey on other children," end quote. Right, thank you very, very much for listening. This case was an interesting one to research, mainly because of how I discovered about how it had happened. And I wish there was a bit more information available about it. There's not a great deal, to be honest. There's bits and pieces, but it's mostly the same sort of stuff. And then I'm just glad I was able to share the case with all of you that are listening. If even one person has found out something they didn't know or has been touched by this story, then I see it as a success. Obviously, I went off on a couple of little tangents along the way, but I'll probably do that in every case that I cover. If I find something relevant, I'm always going to give my opinion on these cases, as well as opinions on sort of topics that are raised during my research of these cases. But I hope you enjoyed listening anyway, and I hope you will all join me again next time. Anyway, that's going to wrap things up for now. As I said, hopefully you will all join me for another case very soon. Until then, don't have nightmares, take care, and bye-bye for now.